Hello again, this is Brian McClanahan, and today we're going to talk about the war between the states, the war for Southern independence, what's often commonly called the Civil War, which of course is not an accurate term, and I'm going to talk about that in a few minutes. In fact, I've titled this presentation Mr. Lincoln's War, because essentially that's what it is. In the last presentation, we talked about how Lincoln essentially started this war. He goaded the South into firing the first shots at Fort Sumter. He knew exactly what he was doing. He was polling his cabinet just 11 days after taking office, asking to provision Fort Sumter, which he knew full well would cause war. He knew what he was doing, and the reason why he was doing this, of course, was to save his party. Lincoln was never really concerned about saving the Union. It was all about the Republican Party and, of course, Republican dominance. And what we're going to do, of course, in this presentation is talk about some of the military aspects of the war very briefly. And normally I could spend a long period of time talking about that particular part of the war. But I'm going to talk about that in a brief short discussion on those particular things. And then, of course, I will talk about some of the political ramifications of the war and what's happening in the northern area with northern civilians, and of course in the south with southern civilians, so the northern home front and southern home front, because both those things need to be looked at in detail. So this is going to be a very non-traditional way of looking at the war. You're not going to get a whole lot of bullets and cannon here. I am going to talk about that stuff, but you're also going to get some of the political elements. And then, of course, in the next couple of presentations, I will actually go back into the war when I start talking about Reconstruction, because ultimately that's what this war is entirely about. This is a watershed, a turning point in American history. This is when the Union is recreated. This is not when the Union is reconstructed. It's recreated. In 1861, when the first shots are fired at Fort Sumter, the original Union of the Founders died. From that point forward, we no longer have it. And I think sometimes when we sang what they said at this time, hosannas to the Union was gone. There was no hope in saving it. And the Union of the Founders was definitely gone. So when today, when conservatives or libertarians, whoever you are, start talking about saving the Constitution, saving the Republic, the Federal Republic under the Constitution, well, it's been gone since 1861, and I think we need to critically reassess everyone who comes after Abraham Lincoln and Lincoln himself and look at how that happened. If you're going to say that you're against strong executive authority, then by no means you should ever admire Abraham Lincoln, because this guy ran all over the Constitution. He did not follow it. He was not a founding father. He really didn't care about it. And he was more concerned about saving his party. And so I think that as we move forward, you know, keep that in mind. Oftentimes, you know, Lincoln's considered one of the greatest presidents in American history, and unjustifiably so. This guy should not even be in the top 40. Okay, so, you know, Lincoln is a disaster. And of course, this war is a disaster. It's a disaster for the United States. It's a disaster for the South. It's a disaster for the future of constitutional government. There's nothing good that comes out of it, with the exception of the end of slavery. But the question always is, you know, could slavery have ended some other way? Were Northerners self-righteous in their cause? You know, were they justified in their cause here? Could slavery have been abolished, say, through compensated emancipation or some other means? Well, certainly it could. I mean, there's no reason to think that a war needed to be fought to end slavery in the United States. Again, the territories in the West, we're talking about 20 slaveholders and 46 slaves. That was the area they're battling over, not slavery in the South, because they really wanted to confine it there. And we're going to look at how Northerners thought of Black Americans, both free and slave, in this particular presentation. And how this idea that these crusading Northerners, you know, were concerned about Black people in the United States and the South just isn't true. Okay, so let's start with this term, a civil war. This is by no means a civil war. Now, if you want to look at, say, Missouri, you could have said there was a civil war because there was fight for the control of the state government of Missouri. Same thing possibly in Kentucky. But that's really it. A civil war is fought for control of a government. One faction against another faction for controlling a government. This is not a civil war. It's not a civil war because the South didn't want to control the United States. In fact, they said, sayonara, we're out of here. So in that way, they're declaring their independence, just like the Founding Fathers did in 1776. There's no difference here. And in fact, that was brought up continually in the South. What you're doing here by saying you cannot have your independence is spitting on the founding principles of the United States: liberty, independence, free and independent states. So when the Union prosecutes this war, they're acting as the British. It's a war of empire, basically, for the United States to conquer the South. And when we get to the quote-unquote Reconstruction period, they basically say that. The South are conquered provinces, and that's how they looked at it. So Lincoln called the war a war of rebellion. Again, this is a political move, because if he says that secession actually happens, then you have to have a formal declaration of war. And by recognizing the Confederacy, that makes secession legitimate. Well, Lincoln's not going to do that. So he calls it a war of rebellion, and essentially by doing that too, he's caused problems for himself, because Lincoln cannot invade a state without the state's consent, and the southern states don't consent to be invaded, to have federal troops called in to coerce it. I mean, Madison talked about this, that this would never happen in 1788, and of course many of the founders during that particular period of framing the Constitution and ratifying it said that the states cannot be coerced without their consent. So here we have 11 states being coerced without their consent. Completely illegal. But it happens anyways. I mean, this is, again, if we're going to start talking about constitutional government, you cannot admire Abraham Lincoln one iota. This guy trampled all over the Constitution and the founding principles. So the South seceded from the Union. Remember, Georgia and South Carolina, North Carolina, Virginia, these states rescinded the ratification of the Constitution. The other states, as co-equal sister states, could do the same thing. Of course, they declared their independence, essentially. And that's exactly what the original 13 states did in 1776. They declared their independence from the British Empire. No different here in the South. So this would more accurately be described as a war for Southern independence. You could say it's a war of Northern aggression, the war between the states, whatever you want to say. But it's by no means a civil war. And I think we need to start dropping that term. Northerners and Southerners had not seen eye to eye for a very long time, and they weren't fighting for control of one government. The South said, you can have it. You can have the United States. We're going to have our own government. We'll have our own republic, and you can have yours. So I think we need to get that out of the way. I'm not going to use the term civil war, even though that's popular. And you go into any bookstore, there's the quote-unquote civil war section. You have Ken Burns' Civil War. This is not a civil war. Okay, now, what's the importance of the war? Well, in so many ways, this is the holy grail of American history. It's the holy grail because if you can control the interpretation about the war, then you control American history. It's Orwellian. You know, who controls the present controls the past. Who controls the past controls the future. So, this is exactly what's happening here. If you can portray the South as treasonous demons, then by no means can you like the South. And of course, you're going to have to like the North, and you're going to have to like their cause, and you're going to have to like this self-righteousness that the North had. Remember, Allen Evans said that there's no political convention in American history so full of self-righteousness as the Republican convention in the 1850s and 60s. I mean, these people believed that they were completely right in all of this, that the South were just these pig, is vomiting spew, drunken vomit on the bottom of their shoe. That's what Southerners were. They weren't members of the same federal republic. They were just people to abuse. And I think that's important. And of course, that perception of Southerners has carried forward. Southerners are, it's fun to make jokes of Southerners because they can't really defend themselves. In that way. I mean, you're chic, you're hip if you make fun of Southerners. Southerners, of course, and kind of going on the side here, Southerners, of course, if you look at American heroes, almost all of them are Southern. There are very few Northern American heroes. Primarily, they're all Southern. So, I mean, the South really was the dominant section in the United States for a very long period of time, and the North knew it, which is why they really didn't want the South to have any political power whatsoever, because they were going to be the minority if that happened. And so this sectional conflict was completely about political power. Again, if you control how people view that sectional conflict, you control how they think about what they're doing today, voting, how they think about the federal government, what they think about the executive branch, what they think about the Constitution. I mean, all these things matter, and it all goes back to this particular period of time, 1861 to 1865. By saying secession is illegal, secession is treason, by saying that the United States is indivisible, as as Bellamy did in writing the Pledge of Allegiance, the socialist minister Bellamy in writing the Pledge of Allegiance, by saying that, you are changing the way Americans think about the Federal Republic. It was not always indivisible. And I think that clearly that's the case throughout American history. And again, this is a transition from a Federal Republic to an empire. We go from the idea of the United States and being that, sure, that there was expansion. We talked about that, the Mexican War, the Gadsden Purchase. Of course, before that, the Louisiana Purchase. The United States is expanding west. But the idea was that you would always have separate states there, co-equal states. And Jefferson, of course, again, thought that these states would be equal with the original states. And he also thought that eventually there will be several republics on North America, not just one large republic. There will be several federal republics, not just one conglomeration of people. And I think that's where you start getting this idea that the one nation idea. Of course, this did float around before that. I mean, I'm not saying that, you know, in the founding period, there weren't people that called the United States one nation and this type of thing. But this one nation idea really is solidified between 1861 and 1865. And this evangelical spirit, I'm not talking about religion here, but this crusade to conquer and make everyone be one people will then carry on to foreign policy beyond this. And it's also during this period the United States gets involved in thinking about liberty in other parts of the world and actually being actively involved in pursuing it. For example, Crete had an independence movement. The United States Republicans are very concerned about Crete. Well, what for? Who cares about Crete? Or other parts of the world? And of course, once you can conquer the South and make them assimilate, then you can conquer the Western Indian tribes and make them assimilate and on down the line. So this is definitely part of this crusading imperial spirit that we're going to start seeing. And this is the transition, 1861 to 1865. And again, the trampling of the Constitution takes place here. Now, we have seen executive abuse before this, of course, with Andrew Jackson, with James K. Polk. You can talk about that. And even George Washington, it can be said that Washington trampled on the Constitution in his second term in office in particular. But for the most part, the presidents that are considered bad presidents, and I've talked about that, Buchanan and Pierce and people like that, they're not trampling on the Constitution. They're trying to very carefully implement executive authority. That goes out the window after 1865, really after 1861. It's gone. This adherence to the Constitution of the Founders, that's gone. So trampling the Constitution becomes a very popular thing to do. In fact, after Lincoln, there's really only one president in American history who really didn't in any way trample the Constitution, and that would be Grover Cleveland. Every other president, you can find something that they did that was pretty much unconstitutional. Maybe the 1920s with Coolidge and Harding. But beyond that, you're really not seeing a whole lot here from American presidents in adhering to their constituted authority. It's gone. And again, it's also the implementation of the Hamiltonian system. I mean, that's an important part of this war. It's economic reconstruction. And when I start talking about reconstruction, that's a big part of it. Making sure that once this war is over, if the North wins, the South will no longer be able to block anything the North wants to do in terms of political economy. And all the political economic woes we point to today, all the problems with federal spending, all the problems with the central banking system, all of these problems really point their origins back to this time period when the South could no longer block this stuff and the North puts it into effect. In fact, when we start talking about the late 19th century and look at things like the Gilded Age, and again, we're going to get into this Reconstruction, but the Gilded Age, the populist movement, this is in so many ways a byproduct of this war and the Hamiltonian system being forced down Americans' throats. And again, finally, Lincoln is the first modern president. This is also why the war is important. Lincoln is the first guy in so many ways to use the executive authority like modern presidents do, just to basically say, I'm going to do what I want. The Congress will follow my lead. I'm going to tell the Congress what to do, and therefore it becomes an executive government rather than a legislative or congressional government. I mean, essentially today, when we say the president is going to do this, this, and this, the president has his plan, the president has his legislation, I mean, we have an elected king. And that's essentially what you're getting in Abraham Lincoln. The Congress just did whatever he wanted, and they used every faulty legal argument they could to make sure that stuff went into effect. I mean, this is crazy. But that's what's happening here. You know, Lincoln suspends habeas corpus. Well, there's nothing in the Constitution that says the president can do that. Congress just said, okay, Lincoln did it, and we're going to follow suit and say it's fine, it's legal. It's foolish. I mean, but this is what starts happening in American history. The president does something, then Congress will come up with some legal argument why the president could do it, and therefore it's fine. And as long as your guy's in office, you don't care. If the opposition gets in office, well, wait a second here. We don't like that. I mean, Barack Obama, for example, in this administration from 2009 forward, is not doing anything different than other presidents have done. But because he's not a Republican, he has no R after his name. Republicans are all over him for it. But if it was a Republican in office, well, they'd be fine with it. Same thing with Democrats. When George W. Bush is in office, the Democrats are all over executive power. But now that their guy's in office, they don't care. Americans love executive authority from this point forward, because they think that's how they're going to get what they want. You know, a government that's dominated by the legislature is a slow-moving, slow-acting government that really doesn't do a whole lot, because that's the nature of legislative power. It is hard to get things done. That's a good thing. We don't want that central authority doing anything but general business. And of course, nowadays, it does more than just the general business of the union. It does all kinds of things that it shouldn't be doing. This is the beginning of that. So we go all the way back to this period. Again, it's just such a watershed, such an important point. It's the holy grail of American politics right here. If you can dominate, control how people think about this war, if you can change their mind about it, then you can change the way people view current American politics. Now, that said, we actually have to talk about, again, rifles and cannons here. So it's important to mention the military balance sheet from the beginning. The question should not be why the South lost the war. It should be why the North barely won this war. I mean, if you look at the military balance sheet from the beginning, the North should have won this thing from the start. And there should have been no reason the South hung around for 4 years. In fact, Shelby Foote, who's a great popular historian, wrote a wonderful narrative of the war. If you've never read it, you need to read it. Said essentially that the North was fighting the war with one hand tied behind their back. True. But it's also no less true that there wasn't a whole lot of popular support for this war in the North at particular times of this war, which is why they had to fight the war with one hand tied behind their back. The Northern population really didn't support it a whole lot. At times. There were times they did, and when the war wasn't going well, they didn't. So the South is able to hang on for 4 years against tremendous odds. Tremendous odds. I mean, the North has everything in place to win this war. The South has nothing. It's also important to note that if the North had actually followed Winfield Scott's Anaconda Plan, which is what Scott put forward in 1861 and trying to argue that Lincoln should not provision Fort Sumter, this war doesn't really even happen the way it does. In fact, it's the Anaconda Plan that wins the war for the North. Essentially, the Anaconda Plan said, we're going to blockade the South. We're going to cut off their trade. We're going to basically strangle them out. And they'll eventually come to their senses when they can't trade their cotton, when they're running out of food, and these type of things. They'll come around, and they'll come back in the Union. We didn't need to fire any shots at the South. They would simply just buckle. And essentially, that's what happens. The blockade and not allowing the South to trade their cotton and essentially forcing the South to be self-sufficient. They couldn't get a lot of industrial goods. They couldn't get as much, they had plenty of food for the most part. But I mean, even trying to get food from one part of the South to the other became very difficult. So they essentially, choke out the South. And that's why the South buckles near the end of the war. It wasn't because the North kept on winning and winning and winning. I mean, the South is winning all the way up until 1864, just shortly before the war ends. So in terms of military battles, they were doing very well, and particularly in the Eastern Theater, not in the West, but in the Eastern Theater. So it's this blockade, this Anaconda Plan that's going to win the war for the North. Now, we also know the war is not going to be short nor bloodless. There are people in the South and the North who thought this thing would be over with one battle. In fact, there was one Confederate politician who said he could wipe up all the blood that would be spilled with his handkerchief in this war. Of course, that's not going to happen. And I think, unfortunately, there were some people that thought that way. There were others who didn't, who thought this was going to be a long, bloody conflict that was not going to be good for either the North or the South in the long run. And it wasn't. And again, this is also the first modern war. Now, what you're going to see in this war are practices that we'll see in other wars, but this is the beginning of it. For example, trench warfare. We start to see trenches used near the end of the war by the South in particular to defend their positions. Well, essentially, when we get to World War I, that's what World War I is all about. Ironclad ships, the technology that's used for the navies, both North and South, that is going to be carried forward, and you're going to get modern battleships out of that. You're going to start seeing also other battlefield technologies. For example, repeating rifles, machine guns will start to be used near the end of the war. I mean, all this stuff comes out of it. And I mean, that's really important for the future. It's also the way that the armies start thinking about civilian populations. Now, of course, if you look at European wars back before this, and you go to, say, for example, the Hundred Years' War, and other time periods, you know, the Viking Crusades and things like that, I mean, civilians were forfeit. But from that point forward, you had this general consensus among European powers that civilians should be left out of warfare, and that warfare was between armies. Well, here again in the 1860s, civilians become forfeit. Civilian property becomes forfeit. Tremendous property destruction is the name of the game for the Union in particular. So they start throwing all the old rules out the window when it comes to warfare. And from this point forward, that's what you're going to see. You're not going to see a respect for civilian populations or property in modern warfare. And this is where it begins. I mean, again, you had elements of this in wars before that, but on a wholesale policy, you just don't see it until the American War Between the States. Now, what kind of Confederate advantages were there? Well, they had better generals for the most part, particularly in the Eastern Theater. You're talking about Robert E. Lee, Thomas Stonewall Jackson, Albert Sidney Johnston. In fact, we'll talk about Johnston when we get to the Battle of Shiloh, but if Johnston had not been killed, the war in the West might have been different. So they have better generals. They have good, hard-fighting, dedicated soldiers. 75% of the white male population in the South is going to fight in this war. They're dedicated to the cause. And I think there's a general perception out there among the modern historical profession, particularly among leftists, that that wasn't the case, but it was the case. And of course, they had knowledge of the land. The war is fought in the South primarily, with the exception of really one major battle. So you're talking about this war being fought on Southern soil. So they know the area, they know the land, and that's going to work to their advantage at times. However, that's not a whole lot of advantages. Again, it's remarkable the South was able to hang in this war for 4 years. That shows a true dedication to the cause. On the other hand, what did the North have? Well, they had a government, an established government. The South had to put that together. I mean, it's really remarkable. They formed this government in Montgomery in 1861. They write a permanent constitution, and they're trying to put this thing together on the fly during a time of war. It's very hard to do that. I mean, the United States essentially had to do that in the War for Independence. The South is having to do the exact same thing. And if it wasn't for French recognition and support in that American War for Independence, maybe the United States doesn't win. The South didn't have that advantage. They didn't have anyone come to their aid here in 1861 to 65. So they're having to put this thing together. The North has already got it. They've got the machine ready to go wage war. The North, of course, has an army and a navy. You know, the South's navy paled in comparison to the North. You know, the North had a West Point, and they had an Annapolis. They had a Naval Academy and a U.S. Military Academy at Annapolis for the Army. A West Point. The South didn't have any of those things. The South's Naval Academy was a ship, and that they had, in a river. I mean, that's it. That was their Naval Academy. So they had to build a Navy. They had to build an Army. Those are very hard things to do. They had to supply these people. They had to have weapons, ammunition, cannon, boots, uniforms, all of these things. Very hard things to get, food. All of this stuff is extremely difficult for the South. The North had plenty of supply, which is when we get to POWs at the end of this presentation, why their abuse of Southern POWs is so profound, because they could have fed those people and they just decided not to. So the North has these things. The North also has all the major financial houses. The South doesn't have any of that stuff, really. So financing the war is a lot easier in the North. It's terribly difficult to finance the war in the South. I mean, you know, we talk about Confederate money and bonds and how worthless they were at the end. Well, the South had no means of really financially supporting itself in this very expensive war. It's really remarkable, again, that the South is able to do so many things. For example, in their Navy, I mean, the technology they used, they couldn't build as many ships, but they could build good ships in terms of technology. I mean, the first submarine to sink a vessel is done by the South, the CSS Hunley, in the history, recorded history of military warfare. So, it's remarkable the South could do this stuff. They were very ingenious, tremendous ingenuity here. And so I think that sometimes we just think, well, I mean, the North had all these advantages. and the South was doomed from the beginning. Well, the South really hung in there, even though they did have insurmountable odds, it seemed. The North, of course, had industrial production. You start talking about iron foundries and things of that nature when you have to have cannon and, again, rifles and swords and all of these things, bayonets. Well, the North can build these things much more efficiently than the South. You're going to get some of these things in the South, but not enough really to turn the tide of the war. The North could just keep producing this stuff. The South had shortages at times. The North had a greater population, basically 2-to-1. And that's if you count slaves. I mean, you're talking about 20 million people in the North for the most part in that area, and about 10 million in the South, 11 million maybe. And again, about 3 million of those people were slaves. So all of the Northern population counted when you talk about people who are going to fight in this war. Not all the Southern population counted. There would be black Confederates, but a very small number compared to how many white Southerners actually fought in the war. And of course, a commitment to total war by 1862. Once the North decided to punish the South, it really put a burden on the South in ways that they couldn't handle. Again, the civilian population is going to be as much a part of this war in the South as the soldiers themselves. So that's a real issue here. Now, let's talk about some of these major battles in the East. And again, I'm going to quickly go through these things because I'm more concerned about some of the other elements of this war, not the battles themselves. But of course, the very first major battle of the war is the Battle of First Manassas or Bull Run, and it takes place in July of 1861. Now, we often see two names for battles, and that's because there's the southern names for battles and the northern names for battles, same battle. In this case, First Manassas is the southern name for the battle, Bull Run is the northern name for the battle. The North often named battles after bodies of water, like Bull Run Creek. The South often for locations. This battle takes place in Manassas Junction. So that's why you see two different names. And you see that for many of the battles. There's very few that's in the Eastern Theater in particular where you have a common name. Now, in the Western Theater, a little different. But in the Eastern Theater, you see a lot of two names for battles. What they realized in this particular battle is that the war was not going to be short nor bloodless, and there was going to be a terrible cost of this war. There was a tremendous loss of life in this first battle. You know, the interesting thing about this battle, you know, people thought what was going to happen is that the North was going to show up, the South was going to show up, they'd fire their weapons a little bit, they'd yell and scream, and then they'd all just say, all right, enough of that, and the war's over. The North thought maybe if they had a supreme showing of force here, the South would just give up. And in the early phases of this battle, it appeared to be a northern rout. This is when Stonewall Jackson is going to get his name Stonewall, because Jackson is going to march in to set up a defensive position. And as the South is retreating and being routed, they all rally around Jackson, and Jackson is able to push the North back, and it becomes a southern rout. So people realize here the South is not going to give up. They're not just going to run home with their tail between their legs. Northerners had showed up in droves to watch this battle from the hills around the battlefield. They brought picnic lunches and things like that. Hey, let's go watch the battle today. And of course, they're running back with the Union Army to Washington, D.C. as fast as they can. But again, this is the point where people realize this war is going to be a long war. The South is determined to fight, and we need to be very careful about this because, you know, this thing's not going to be over in 1 year. We're not going to be back by Christmas. So that first Battle of Manassas is important for that reason. Again, sets the stage for what's going to happen for the rest of the war. Then, of course, what happens is the pace of the war will slow down in so many ways after that first Battle of Manassas. Lincoln is very much running this war from the executive branch. And what he does during this period of time is try to find generals who are going to fight the war the way he wants them to fight the war. And that's important to note, too, because when he settles on Grant, Grant's reputation and what he was doing in the West is indicative of what Lincoln wanted to do. Again, there's this idea that Lincoln was just, you know, he had with malice toward none. You know, we don't want to have any malice toward the South. We want to let them up easy. Well, that's awful funny because what he's doing consistently is putting his boot on their neck. And in terms of the Southern population, he believes that the South needs to be abused. I mean, by selecting Grant, I mean, that's the guy that he wanted. And, you know, if we look at it that way, Lincoln is not this benevolent president who's just, you know, reluctantly waging this war against the South. He's kicking them everywhere he can. And Grant was the guy that was going to do that. So before Grant, though, is put in charge of the Eastern Theater and the strategy in the East to try to get Lee out of the way, Grant, of course, is in the West, but Lincoln has all of these different generals, you know, George McClellan, who will later run for president. You know, he, of course, is at this point the guy that Lincoln has in command of the Army of the Potomac. McClellan was an artillery guy, and all he ever wanted was more men and more material because he wanted overwhelming odds to try to overwhelm the South. If you're fighting a siege type situation, which is what Lincoln wanted to do, he wanted to capture Richmond and capture the Confederate capital, which had been now moved to Richmond, and end the war. Well, McClellan says, we need more men, we need more men. And McClellan's a very slow, plodding type general. Lincoln wants quick action, and eventually he's going to force McClellan into going to attack the South in Richmond. And this is what leads to what's called the Peninsular Campaign and the Seven Days Battles. These are a disaster for the North. McClellan will win a few of the battles here in this entire campaign, but for the most part, the South is able to keep the North out of Richmond, and they're able to punish them and abuse them constantly. The North will start to wear down. The population of the North starts to look at this and say, well, my gosh, what are we doing here? We can't win. We're doing terrible here in 1861. The Peninsular Campaign and Seven Days Battles are also important because Robert E. Lee at that point will be put in charge of the Army of Virginia. And it's Lee who has a much more aggressive stance than his predecessor, Joseph E. Johnston. Johnston's removed. Lee is put in command. And of course, Lee, by far, next to maybe Albert Sidney Johnston in the South, was viewed as the best general. And what we'll find out throughout this war, I mean, of course, Albert Sidney Johnston is killed. But Lee is by far the best general in the war. In fact, Winfield Scott wanted Lee to command the Army of the Potomac. But when Virginia secedes, Lee goes with Virginia. He stays with his state and the Lee family, of course, which had been in Virginia since the 1600s. So Lee is not going to fight against his home state. So you have this Peninsular Campaign, which is an outright disaster for the North. McClellan has to go back around Virginia with his tail tucked between his legs. Lincoln is frustrated. He replaces McClellan, and this starts a revolving door. I mean, the number of generals who are commanding this Army of the Potomac is you know, tremendous. I mean, he fires and fires them practically. Lee is going to command the Army of Virginia for most of the war. So you can see there the stability of the South mattered in this Virginia theater of operations. The North kept having to change generals. And again, Lincoln's trying to find a guy who's going to fight the war the way he wants, to punish the South, to go out there and take it to the South. That's what Lincoln wants to do. He's not this benevolent guy, again, who just, you know, loves Southerners and wants to let them up easy. He says those things, but that's not the way that his actions don't follow suit. It's also in this particular period of time you have something called the Valley Campaign. Jackson, Stonewall Jackson, who has made a name for himself at First Manassas, now has gone to the Shenandoah Valley. And what he's trying to do there is root the Union out of the Shenandoah Valley. This is a great area to supply the Confederacy, in Virginia in particular. Now, there's a lot of foodstuffs to be had there. And he's also trying to keep the Union from surrounding Robert E. Lee and surrounding Richmond, most importantly. And this campaign is important. It's called the Valley Campaign because this thing is still studied at West Point. I mean, Jackson's use of his army here and splitting his army and facing a much larger Union presence and winning consistently. I mean, people still look at this and marvel at it, how Jackson was able to do this. This is why Jackson was perhaps the best tactical commander of the war, the best tactical general. Lee would have probably been the best strategic general, but Jackson the best tactical general. And of course, these two together was a fearsome duo. And the South is going to suffer severely once Jackson is killed in battle. But at this point, Jackson is doing a great job in keeping the Union off balance and not allowing them to surround Richmond and put Lee in a vice. This is exactly, the Union is doing exactly what the British wanted to do with George Washington. And in that way, Lee is following suit with George Washington. I mean, Washington was his hero, Washington from Virginia. Lee understands you keep the army in the field, you keep the cause alive. If he's captured, and Lincoln knew this too, if he's captured, the war's over. They take Richmond. So as long as Lee can stay in the field, the war can be a success for the South. And essentially, that's what's going to happen for 4 years. There are a number of opportunities that the Union Army passes up on in getting rid of Lee and capturing Lee and getting his army off the field, but they miss him all the time. So Lee's able to keep this thing going. Okay, Lee, as I said, was much more important for the Southern cause because he fights the war in a different manner. You know, Joseph E. Johnston, not Albert Sidney Johnston, two Johnstons here. Joseph E. Johnston was a defensive person. defend Richmond, build fortifications, keep the North out of Richmond, and you can maintain the war that way. Lee thought they need to take the war to the North. So he has plans to invade the North. And what he's going to do is try to get into, say, Pennsylvania. So in 1862, Lee decides that the time is right to invade the North, and he's going to try to go through Western Maryland. Now, Maryland, of course, was, remember, coerced to stay in the Union. There's a large Confederate group of sympathizers in Maryland, and there are a large number of Confederate soldiers in Maryland, from Maryland, I should say. And so Lee decides he's going to move up through Western Maryland. Well, this is one of the great chances in history. As some Union scouts are kicking around a encampment that was left behind by the Confederacy, they come across a bundle of cigars, and rolled in the cigars are all of Lee's battle plans. And so at this point, again, McClellan, who had been replaced, is now back in command. He uncharacteristically moves very quickly to meet Lee, and this leads to the Battle of Sharpsburg or the Battle of Antietam. This is the single bloodiest day of the war. There were 22,000 casualties in one day, one battle. I mean, that just boggles the mind. You know, in all the years we've been fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan, and it's terrible, every single one of those lives is important, but we've only had 6,000 deaths in 10 years. Shouldn't even be there to begin with, but the fact is you've had 6,000 deaths in 10 years, perhaps 30,000 casualties in 10 years. In this particular battle, you're getting 22,000 in one day. I mean, so it just puts it all in perspective how terrible this war was in terms of loss of life and casualties and, you know, wounded, I mean, killed and wounded. It's horrible. But that's what happens here. In fact, the Union Army just lets the South have it. They have a good defensive position, and the South futilely charges against the Union Army over and over again, and it's just a terrible situation. This battle, though, is important politically for Abraham Lincoln, you see, because until this point, the South was winning. They had won virtually every single major battle. Now you have a situation where Lincoln has an opportunity with a Union victory to issue the Emancipation Proclamation, and I'll talk about that in a second. There's also one more important Confederate victory in this particular time. What Sharpsburg was for the Union Army, Fredericksburg was for the Confederate Army. The Union Army is pinned up at Fredericksburg. They actually have to cross a river, go through a large open field into an entrenched Confederate position at Fredericksburg, and they suffer terrible loss of life in doing this. So this was retribution, the South thought, for the terrible losses at Sharpsburg. Fredericksburg was the exact same thing for the Confederacy. In fact, it's during this particular battle that Lee is reported to have said, "It is well that war is so terrible, else men would learn to love it too much." He's looking at the carnage on the battlefield, and he's saying, "Gosh, that's terrible, but this is great fun because we're winning." I mean, that's the way that, you know, war can do that. It's exhilarating in that way, and people have talked about that. But of course, it's also terrible at the same time. So, as I mentioned before, this Sharpsburg Antietam will allow Lincoln to start putting plans in motion for the Emancipation Proclamation. That victory leads to that. And the Emancipation Proclamation was issued in September of 1862. And essentially, this was a political move. Lincoln knew full well that if the British or the French, but most of the British, recognized the Confederacy and broke the blockade, that was going to cause severe problems for the Union Army and the Union in general, because the South now could get their cotton out, they could get money, they could get supplies, and so that's going to be a real difficult situation. So Lincoln will issue this Emancipation Proclamation as a means to keep the British out of the war. And it works. The British, as making slavery a war aim, ending slavery, means that the British, who are a non-slaveholding country at this time, perhaps will not want to prosecute this war and get involved in it. And again, it keeps the British out. But it did not free one slave. I mean, the common misconception among Americans is that the Emancipation Proclamation freed slaves. Well, it didn't free any, because it only freed slaves in the South. And of course, the Union doesn't control the South at this point. So Lincoln, in fact, had tried several plans to try to get rid of slavery in the North. Remember, Delaware is still a slave state. Maryland is still a slave state. They control parts of Kentucky, Missouri. Those are still slave areas. In fact, slavery didn't end in the Union until December of 1865 with the 13th Amendment to the Constitution. That's 8 months after the war is over, for the most part. So Lincoln tries compensated emancipation, where he's going to pay slave owners for their slaves. Well, that doesn't fly because the North doesn't want to do it. He tries colonization. That doesn't work because, of course, the North thinks that's too expensive, and black Americans don't want to go back to Africa. I mean, this is not something they want to do. This is their home. So all of those plans are going to fail. The end result, of course, with the Emancipation Proclamation is that the British will stay out of the war, which works to the Union's advantage. So this Emancipation Proclamation, far from being this noble moral cause, was really nothing more than a political move to keep foreign powers at bay and allow the Union to continue to, hopefully, in their mind, win this war.